SiriusXM's POTUS and the Brookings Institution bring you an exclusive production, The Metropolitan Revolution, a conversation with innovators around the country who are leading in efforts to reshape our economy and fix our broken political system. From the SiriusXM POTUS studios in Washington, D.C., here's Tim Farley with Bruce Katz of the Brookings Institution.
Welcome to the special presentation on POTUS, a program we hope that will convince you that there is a part of America that is working. Something's happening in communities like yours, and it's contagious. In the next hour, you'll be hearing from John Fry, president of Drexel University in Philadelphia, who will be talking about how cities can supercharge their innovation economies. Mary Sue Barrett, president of the Chicago Metropolitan Planning Council, we'll be sharing ideas on infrastructure in its many forms, roads, rail, air, water, sewer, energy, broadband, all of which have a major influence on a community's success. And Angela Blanchard, who is president and CEO of Neighborhood Centers, Inc., will be talking about the shifting demographics in cities and metros, given the immigration dynamics. A lot to talk about, and we are going to do it with Bruce Katz. He is the vice president and director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. He is the co-author with Jennifer Bradley of The Metropolitan Revolution, hence the name of this program, and he is here. Bruce, welcome to the studios.
Thanks for having me.
This is a work that you have dedicated quite a bit of time to, not just time in town, but also, I guess, a lot on the road for your investigations.
I've got a lot of frequent flyer miles. What I have found, and what Jennifer and I have found, is that cities and metropolitan areas in the United States no doubt face big economic, social, competitive challenges. What we've also found is they're on their own. Washington has essentially left the building, is not riding to the rescue. The good news is we see cities and metropolitan areas, not just governments, not just mayors and county leaders, but business leaders, philanthropists, university leaders. They're stepping up and they're doing the hard work to grow more and better jobs. They're investing in infrastructure. They're making advanced manufacturing a priority. They're equipping workers with the skills they need to compete. And they're doing this because cities and metropolitan areas are very powerful in the U.S., engines of the economy, but with many resources and other power.
How hard was it to find success stories?
It's not hard at all, actually, because when you go to the local level, when you go to ground, what you don't find is hyperpartisanship and ideological polarization. You find a whole bunch of leaders who are very pragmatic, very affirmative, very positive. We had to cull really several dozen examples down to seven for this book, but we could have included all of them.
Mm-hmm. Is there an area where especially there is commonality, whether it's a large city, a small city? I mean, infrastructure, obviously, everyone has potholes. But on the other hand, not everyone has huge bridges and traffic clogs going into town. But where are the areas that are shared, not just because of the fact that they're cities, but all sizes?
I think the big commonality is that cities are not governments. The federal government is a government.
Mm-hmm.
States are governments. Cities are really networks of institutions and leaders. So depending on your size, yes, the challenges will differ. An innovation challenge, an infrastructure challenge. Education and skills are ubiquitous. They're uniform across the country. The demographic transition you mentioned. But it's the network that tends to solve things in the United States. Local political leaders working closely with private, civic, and university leaders.
Now, you mentioned because the federal government has sort of checked out. I wonder how important the state government is.
States are critical. I mean, to a large extent, cities and metropolitan areas are creatures of state law, at least their governments are. And there are some really powerful stories in the book and elsewhere where governors and state legislatures are acting in the service of their city and metro economies. But that's not uniform across the U.S. either.
Mm. Who's attracted to serving in these communities, either as politicians or business leaders? What drives those individuals? I can just imagine that the people are a big part of this equation.
Leadership is a big part of this equation. You know, what I find in the United States is there's an enormous commitment to place. It may be a place you grew up with that, you know, obviously either yourself or your family has been for quite some time. But it's even people who've arrived in a particular city or metropolis feel very strongly about their place and about making their place more prosperous, more competitive, and more inclusive, you know, bring more people along for the ride. So, you know, at the national level, what we're, I think, involved in really is almost a structural combat between the parties,
mm-hmm.
and between these ideological factions. You know, at the local level, there's more of a sense of let's collaborate to compete.
Mm-hmm.
Let's collaborate to make our place better.
You know, one of the things about communities, whether it's cities, small cities, large cities, big towns, small towns, they're still, I think, in this country, a sense of community identity, but a lot of times it's ethnic, a lot of times it's racial. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Is that still a part of the landscape, in your opinion?
It depends somewhat on the community and somewhat on the metropolis. I mean, to some places continue to be fairly racially stratified. Obviously, income inequality and the lack of social mobility is something that is a major challenge for places. But when I go to places, what I find is a sense of pride. You know, it may be around sports. It may be around a particularly traditional industry.
Everyone's happy when their baseball team wins the World Series.
Everyone is happy,
you know,
when their baseball team is doing well. But it's that sense of people want to be connected to something. We're a very, very large country. 315 million people will be 400 million by the middle part of this century. So you can get your arms around a city or a metropolis in a way you can't really get your arms around the nation. And at this point in time, given all the disruptive dynamics at home and around the world, I think that's making community and the sense of community a more important value.
Obviously, we all love to have answers, and I wonder, is there a formula? Are there elements that are necessary for success? We've talked about leadership very briefly, and we'll have a lot more detail, but anything else that's really important?
I think there really are three things at the end of the day. First, form a network, because cities, again, are networks. They're not just elected leaders. So, you know, question is, are your political leaders working close with business, civic, university, et cetera? Second, have a vision that's grounded in real evidence. Don't try to become the next Silicon Valley. You won't. Be the best 21st century version of yourself. One of the great lines I've heard from Dolly Parton, of all people, is figure out who you are and do it on purpose. The fact of the matter is, the Pittsburgh economy is different than the Portland economy, which is different than Philadelphia. So figure out what you're good at, be better at it. And last piece is find your game changer. It might be the extension of your transit system, like in Los Angeles or Denver. It might be attracting a world-beating engineering university, like New York City just did with Cornell and Technion. It might be becoming more of a player on the global trade circuit, like Portland, Oregon is doing with sustainable products and sustainable services. It might even be about restoring the core of your city, like Detroit's doing in their downtown and midtown. But find your game changer and stick to it.
You know, when I was a kid many years ago, when we were studying with the charcoal and the wooden pallets and things like that, like Abe Lincoln. But one of the things we learned in social studies was you needed to be successful for a business in a community or a city, you needed transportation like a river or something to get things in and out of town, goods and services. You needed a stable workforce. You also needed a place where people could actually build certainly not an inhospitable environment. But I wonder, given the internet and the technological changes, if the formulas for success have changed over time.
You know, it's interesting because there was a point of time, you know, 30 years ago where the futurists predicted because of the internet that we'd all be living in the Berkshires.
You know? Right.
We would not need to be grounded in place. Actually, cities and metropolitan areas are becoming a larger force, not just in our economy, but around the world. Look at the growth of cities in China or in India or in Latin America.
Super cities, almost the rule.
Mega cities, right.
Right.
So the U.S., interestingly enough, is the most metropolitan of nations. I mean, all of our metro areas, cities and suburbs together, are about 84% of our population, 91% of our GDP. And if you look at the top 100, they sit on only an eighth of the land mass, two-thirds of the population, three-quarters of the GDP, and everything that matters, talented workers, modern infrastructure, an innovative ecosystem, 75, 80, 85, 90% and above of the nation's share. So even as the internet has allowed people to live anywhere, they tend to be concentrating now in these cities and metropolitan areas. And because of that, the U.S., frankly, is more productive, more competitive, more prosperous.
We are going to hear more success stories, things that are actually working in this country. And listen closely, because you might hear about something that you hear or see in your community, even if we do not speak specifically of it. That is Bruce Katz, Vice President, Director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. The Metropolitan Revolution is what we're talking about. And coming up, John Fry, President of Drexel University in Philadelphia, as we continue the Metropolitan Revolution here on POTUS.
You're listening to an exclusive POTUS event brought to you by the Brookings Institution. From the SiriusXM POTUS studios in Washington, D.C., Here's Tim Farley with Bruce Katz of the Brookings Institution.
Bruce, by the way, is the Vice President and Director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program, the co-author with Jennifer Bradley of The Metropolitan Revolution, which is this program, and we are looking at success stories around the country. Joining us now, John Fry, President of Drexel University in Philadelphia. And Bruce, you guys, I guess, know each other pretty well.
Yes, I actually had the privilege of traveling around the Drexel campus and University City area of West Philly with John a couple of weeks ago, and John, I was just really taken aback by the explosive growth in this community, not just residential and retail, but really the business growth, the startups, the investment happening around not just Drexel, but the University of Pennsylvania, University City Science Center. What's happening and why is it happening at this point in time?
Well, it's interesting. I think that in a way, this was a world unto itself of research universities and, you know, companies that were sort of busy, you know, fulfilling their missions and doing their work. And then I think it occurred to us probably in about the mid-90s that we actually had to start acting like anchor institutions as opposed to, you know, places on the Hill that did only for ourselves. And I think once we took a look at our public environments, took a look at the access to the amazing intellectual, you know, resources and physical resources that we had, and started to act really in concert, you know, over a, you know, 20-plus year period of time, I think what you described has happened. And I think it, honestly, Bruce, I think it took it took some doing to activate these institutions. I think initially in the mid-90s, it was about dealing with deterioration in the public environment, high degrees of crime, deterioration in housing and public education. And I think once we started looking at how to collectively fix those problems, it led us to start talking about, okay, so how do we put this economy on a better growth trajectory going forward? And so it's been a little bit unorthodox, but it is really starting to happen, as you described.
So one thing we're seeing around the country is the growth of what we're calling innovation districts. In fact, you call an innovation neighborhood. And this is the shifting geography of where innovation happens. I mean, 30 years ago, if you wanted to find innovation, frankly, 10 years ago, you get in a car in a downtown or midtown part of a central city, you drive for, you know, 45 minutes, and then you'd be in a science park or suburban corridor. Now what seems to be happening are companies, inventors, talented workers want to be close to advanced research institutions. And companies even want to be working with other companies to invent the new discoveries for the market. So it seems like anchor institutions are playing a much bigger role in the innovative economy. And I just want to see if that's the story in Philadelphia.
I think that absolutely is. I think that, you know, we have, especially at Drexel, two things going for us that I think play right into this topic. One is that we're a cooperative education-based institution, which means basically 90% of my, you know, 12,000-plus undergraduates are in the workforce for between 6 and 18 months during their undergraduate career. So talk about a huge, steady supply of inexpensive labor that, by the way, is highly motivated to build resumes and to have different experiences. Couple that with an institution that has decided to really devote itself more towards translational research, although we do some basic research, means that we have a group of students and faculty who are absolutely willing, able and motivated to work in conjunction with companies that are looking for you know, great talent and also, you know, breakthrough work that will help them increase their own competitive advantages. So I think it's a combination of this unbelievable supply of human capital. Another great thing for Philadelphia, and I think why this innovation neighborhood, as we discussed, is happening, seems to be converging so quickly, is the superior transportation access that we have at 30th Street Station, which is the third busiest Amtrak station in the country, passenger rail. We have about 4.1 million people coming through 30th Street Station every year. Of course, easy access, you know, to the airport, wonderful local public transportation via SEPTA. So we're a very sort of transportation networked, you know, area. And again, it's, as you pointed out, it's very dense. I think we have between Penn and Drexel and the University City Science Center, you know, we have 50, 60,000, you know, jobs right now in this area, and at least as many students, if not more. And this is a very compact area, as you know, and the sort of aggregation of the talent, the density of the people, and then this fabulous location that we have has allowed us to now start thinking about, okay, how do we step back from you know, all these incredible assets and start to organize them, you know, as you suggest, in an innovation district, which is sort of where you catch us right now. We you know, haven't naturally collaborated historically as a group of institutions. Now that clearly is changing because we recognize that we have an ability to put Philadelphia on the map in a big way, just as some other wonderful places have done so, most notably, say, Cambridge.
This is the Metropolitan Revolution on POTUS. I'm Tim Farley, along with Bruce Katz from the Brookings Institution, and we're talking to John Fry, president of Drexel University in Philadelphia. John, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the student body, and it seems like if they have an investment and a sense of participation in the community, that would be an important part of the success. How much of your body, student body, and I guess maybe some of the university student body is drawn from the local area, how many people stay after school because they find it an interesting and maybe a rewarding place to be?
Well, Tim, this used to be a huge problem. I think, you know, probably back again 20 years ago, more often than not, especially for the University of Pennsylvania graduates, and that's where I worked back then, we would lose the vast majority, you know, to New York, to Boston, to San Francisco, to other parts of the country. Probably in the late 90s, we put together an organization called Campus Philly to kind of organize all the educational institutions and begin to, you know, think about ways in which we can make Philadelphia a very attractive place, not only to go to college, which, of course, it's legendary for, but also to stay afterwards. And I think those numbers have doubled in just the last, you know, half dozen or so years. It's a significant number now that are staying. But look, the key to them staying is going to be jobs, you know, safe and clean and vibrant neighborhoods. And then down the road for, you know, many millennials is going to be, you know, the school district. And that's something where we're still struggling. But, you know, the good news is that I think we've taken something that was really a sort of totally unsatisfactory situation, turned it around to where Philadelphia is growing its millennial population by leaps and bounds. I think we've begun to address a lot of the very fundamental issues in terms of attractive and well-paying jobs. These incredibly vibrant and historic and diverse and interesting neighborhoods, you know, and I think the big issue that's on everyone's plate right now is, okay, how do we marry up effective and successful public schools so that as millennials, you know, begin to, you know, plan and have families, they have no reason to leave.
Yeah, John, a quick question. I mean, your language is really quite interesting because you talk about an innovation neighborhood, and literally within a 5-minute or less drive from the heart of Drexel campus are some of the poorest neighborhoods in the Philadelphia metropolis. How do you think about lifting all boats, given the strong economic performance of Drexel and the broader West Philly community?
Well, I think this is an intentional part of our work. I think, you know, we've gone from having this conversation about how do we make this area around, you know, 30th Street Station, which has so much potential, not to be the end game, but to be, you know, part of an opportunity to also, you know, lift up, you know, the prospects for some of these very low income neighborhoods that are almost immediately adjacent, not quite, but certainly within, you know, a half to three quarters of a mile. And I think we've been thinking about this in a couple of different ways, Bruce. One is, as we over time build this innovation neighborhood, how do we create access to jobs and job pipelines for these neighbors in the adjacent neighborhoods, particularly Mantua, which is one of the most distressed neighborhoods in the city? How do we maintain the affordability of those areas? Because the last thing we want to do is have the innovation neighborhood success create gentrification. So how do we create affordable housing to prevent displacement, you know, more mixed income housing, so we can ensure housing affordability for existing residents? And then, of course, there's the education piece, particularly how do we intentionally, you know, build, and we're working on this, a sort of K-12, you know, pipeline, the, you know, internships and apprenticeships for local youth, STEM and STEAM-based programming. And then all of this has to have a sort of wraparound of real authentic engagement and communication and relationship building. And instead of treating it as an isolated neighborhood from the university, embrace it and make it part of this sort of larger innovation neighborhood that we're trying to create. So, look, Bruce, this won't be successful if all we've done is create a huge amount of square feet and jobs around 30th Street Station. This over time, and I'm talking about over decades, should be the catalyst to help us also deal with some of these very low-income neighborhoods where there's very high unemployment and low educational attainment. That is our goal together.
You know, I want to come back to 30th Street Station because this is one of the great train stations in the United States along the Acela Corridor, and you mentioned the statistics before. But you have big ambitions for the remake of 30th Street. For the listeners, you know, when you get out of Acela and at 30th Street, you walk several blocks. You're at the heart of the Drexel campus. But you walk in the other direction, and what you have are freight rail tracks or passenger rail tracks that literally separate the great museum district of Philadelphia from some of the neighborhoods we were just discussing. So I know you have ambitions to literally deck over those tracks and almost build out from the campus and the downtown of the city. Could you describe those?
Sure. So here you have the third busiest passenger rail station in the country. In the fifth largest city in the country, and surrounding all of this is 80 acres of, you know, rail yards, most of which, have the sort of actual train access on either end, you know, the east and the west ends. You know, the east end is the Northeast Corridor. The west end of that rail yard is SEPTA service. And then you have this gigantic kind of valley of Quonset huts and open spaces in the middle. If you flew over Philadelphia and you got to the center of the city on the Schuylkill and you looked down, you'd say, why is there so much vacant land in the middle of this place? And then, of course, as you point out, you just sort of look over the river and there's one of the world's great museums, recently joined by the Barnes on the Parkway, along with the Academy of Natural Sciences and the Franklin Institute, all these cultural riches aligned on the Parkway. You have glorious Fairmont Park and Boathouse Row. Why do you have 80 acres sitting in the middle of this whole area that's undeveloped? So what we've done is ask the question. We've put together a team led by Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, sponsored by Drexel, Amtrak, SEPTA, and Brandywine Property Trust, which is a large landowner in the area as well. And we've basically put together a sort of big tent group of constituencies to study the sort of feasibility and desirability of basically taking advantage of the air rights and the vacant land in this area. And I think, like everything else I'm talking about, this is a very long-term thing. But if we can sort of maybe take some inspiration from what they're doing with Hudson Yards up in New York, we actually think we can achieve something spectacular, which would be to sort of knit Western Center City together with Eastern University City along this beautiful, well-developing river and create 80 more acres of opportunity for commercial and academic and residential and retail and recreational amenities, again, in the fifth largest city in the country. It's sort of an unprecedented opportunity. And if we do our work right in terms of building this sort of innovation neighborhood with the land that we currently control right now, that should be a catalyst to this larger development that we just talked about over the rail yards.
Well, John, what I take away from this conversation is the importance of innovation and innovative economies to urban areas, the importance of anchor institutions to innovation. And you're just extending this out in a way in West Philadelphia with your partners, which is really quite remarkable and I think is very emblematic of the Metropolitan Revolution.
I think what is, first of all, we've taken a lot of inspiration from Bruce's work on innovation districts because, it gives us some real benchmarks where we can see the progress that's been made in other places. And secondly, this whole model is in the end dependent on successful partnerships, between and among academic institutions, commercial institutions, certainly government, and especially our neighbors. And I think that, we now have some real experience in West Philadelphia working together on these types of things. And so, honestly, it gives me a lot of hope and optimism.
John Fry, thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Tim.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, Bruce.
John Fry is the president of Drexel University in Philadelphia. As we continue our discussion, the Metropolitan Revolution, I heard the word we a lot in there, and I'm guessing that's going to be a theme throughout this today as opposed to I. And there's a lot of we, I would guess, in what you're talking about, right?
Well, what we always talk about with cities and metropolitan areas is how do you collaborate to compete?
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about City Hall or the county executive or universities or financial institutions, each one of them is powerful by themselves. When they come together, they can do grand things. That's what's happening in West Philly.
We are going to continue. And up next, Mary Sue Barrett, president of the Chicago Metropolitan Planning Council, will talk infrastructure. And if that doesn't sound sexy, think about the roads you drive on, the bridges you cross, the internet that you access, the energy that you use. That, as we continue this special program, The Metropolitan Revolution, Bruce Katz, vice president, director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. I'm Tim Farley, and we have more coming up in just a moment.
SiriusXM's POTUS and the Brookings Institution bring you an exclusive production, The Metropolitan Revolution. Learn more about the Brookings Institution by visiting brookings.edu. From the SiriusXM POTUS studios in Washington, D.C., here's Tim Farley.
Welcome once again to the program. I'm here with Bruce Katz. Bruce is the vice president and director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. He is also the co-author of The Metropolitan Revolution. And that is the title of this program. We're looking at success stories around the country. And joining us now is Mary Sue Barrett, who is president of the Chicago Metropolitan Planning Council. We're going to talk a little infrastructure. And, Bruce, you know, this has got to be the most exciting thing, infrastructure. Although right. That word makes people crazy because it's about something that's very important in our everyday lives.
Well, and Mary Sue knows more about it than just about anyone in the United States. Mary Sue, great to have you on the program.
I'm glad to be here.
So when I think about Chicago, 9.5 million at the metro scale, about 2.7 million people in the city, I think of this extensive, complicated, sometimes congested, intricate infrastructure system, both the infrastructure that you see, the roads, the rail, the transit, the bike paths, but also the infrastructure you don't see, water, wastewater, energy, broadband. What's the state of infrastructure in Chicago today? What are your challenges? What are your opportunities?
Well, it is a neglected infrastructure. It's infrastructure that we've taken for granted. Of course, we're known as a transportation crossroads. A great thing, first waterways and railroads, roads and now airports, but you have to both maintain the system that you've got and invest in its reinvention constantly. And that's been a hard thing to do. There's also a lot of players, and as Tim suggested, that the infrastructure is not exactly a term that comes up at cocktail parties, and yet it's something that when it doesn't work, your economy doesn't work, your neighborhoods don't work. So we've really been working hard to be part of the solution and not wait for others to solve that problem.
I mean, Chicago is known as a city and metro in the United States that's really invented and experimented with a lot of infrastructure innovation on delivery, on technology. What do you see as the successes in the past 5 or 10 years that other cities and metros should pay attention to?
Well, I think cities and regions everywhere have recognized that we literally cannot build our way out of our problems. Traffic is the most obvious way. Chicago is not just congested some of the time, it's congested on our highways feeding into the city all of the time in both directions. And that is a drag on making attracting growth and attracting investment. So one of the things that's working is to acknowledge that we need to give people more choices. The new bike sharing program called Divvy is enormously popular. It's actually a part of our transit system, although it's not managed by one of our transit agencies. Another example that is about to be implemented is bus rapid transit. That's taking all of the appeal of a train and implementing it at the price tag of a bus system. So it has a dedicated lane, and it gets you from point A to point B much faster because it doesn't stop as often. We're going to be building one under construction right now, in fact, in the Central Business District, right in the Loop, and a second one through the neighborhoods in an area that will connect hospitals and academic institutions. So I think we've recognized that there's new emerging forms. Technology can help us manage our problems better, and that we have to weave together this network to make it easy to use.
So when you've gone about some of these innovations, like bus rapid transit is something that really grew up in Latin America, in Curitiba and Bogota, how much are you looking elsewhere for your innovations, and how much are you just inventing it anew in Chicago?
Well, I think every place considers themselves unique, but the inspiration comes from all over the place. We actually are hosting an event today with the former mayor of Curitiba, Brazil, Jaime Lerner, and a group from Chicago went to Mexico City early on in the planning of bus rapid transit. So we have to be globally networked to learn and to exchange. But Chicago has a lot to teach other places as well, and so we have to share those examples. One specific to stick on bus rapid transit, in the past we might have just looked at, well, what are the most clogged streets and bus routes today, and that might be the only way we would have chosen future bus rapid transit routes. Instead, we looked at where are the places that people are isolated from jobs, where are the food deserts, where are the anchor institutions like hospitals and libraries and grocery stores that people need to get to, and factor all of that in so that we're really serving how people need to connect from home to work, to recreation, and all of those things that make life interesting and convenient. So we're trying to build a system of roads and pedestrian biking and transit options that work for everyone. And that's, of course, an infrastructure that we see. We also have to pay attention to mapping and using technology to, for example, fix a very old network of water and sewer system that undergirds our city.
Mary Sue Barrett is president of the Chicago Metropolitan Planning Council. You're listening to The Metropolitan Revolution. Bruce Katz, vice president, director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. I'm Tim Farley. And Mary Sue, I was going to get to that question about age and how much of that is a problem, because you have aging infrastructure, you have buried pipe, you have copper all over the place, and in some cases you can't replace, or if you do, it's going to be hugely expensive. How much of that is a problem?
It's an enormous problem, and not just for a place that's been around for a long time. We literally have 100-year-old water pipes, and every once in a while the city will unearth a pipe that is a tree trunk. I kid you not. And so those are being replaced. The city went through the process that's always tough of adjusting upward, raising the water rates, because people value clean drinking water. And in fact, the Metropolitan Planning Council was able to quantify that because of leaky pipes, Chicago loses enough water every week to overflow something that's very iconic in Chicago. The size of the Sears Tower, now known as the Willis Tower, it's more than a full tower full of water that we leak every week. And that's enormously inefficient. We obviously can't afford to treat and then waste all that water. So generally, people are on board with fixing century-old pipes. There's also this huge problem that cities are facing, our country is facing, of extreme weather. And so flooding because of heavy storms that our pipes can't absorb is another huge problem. And so building differently before and capturing that rain before it goes into pipes is another new challenge and a big one that cities are having to face.
Can we solve that today, Bruce?
Absolutely.
In the next 20 minutes or so?
Well, That actually does lead me to my next question, which is my favorite topic, which is money. So earlier this year, the Congress had difficulty passing what used to be a no-brainer in Washington, which was a highway trust bill. I think they kicked it out to next year.
Haven't had one since President Obama took office.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So they've been doing two-year spending programs in the last couple of years,
which wreaks havoc, frankly, at the city and metropolitan. There's no predictability, no reliability. How do you deal with financing all the different kind of infrastructure you're talking about, Mary Sue? I mean, it sounds like this is getting a lot more complicated in a very fast period of time.
Well, Bruce, I often borrow a phrase you've used, which is that we're in a self-help era. It's not the world we want to live in, but waiting for Washington or state capitals to act is a recipe for decline. And no region, no city wants to follow that script. So in the metropolitan Chicago region, we are very fortunate that we have a regional governmental agency. It's called CMAP, which stands for Chicago Metropolitan Agency for Planning, and it's joined by another business association that works very closely with Mayor Emanuel called World Business Chicago. they've both laid out a roadmap for very strong infrastructure investment and new tools to pursue that. We're not coming down on one side of the equation or the other as far as who's responsible, public or private sector, for investment. It's going to be, in the future, a blend of both. But we clearly need more expertise and predictability, which has been missing on the funding stream. There's something called the Chicago Infrastructure Trust, which has been part of the solution, and we're looking to other states. Florida, Maryland, California, Virginia are examples of places that have created a statewide infrastructure intermediary. And then you've got the talent, the pipeline, the predictability, standard contracting to take advantage of what today are low interest rates and available capital to get some of these projects moving. They're enormously complex to figure out the right balance of risk and the right mix of investors, but there again, great examples from around the globe.
I'm just thinking about the next 3 or 5 or 10 years. Is there an infrastructure play on the horizon in Chicago, like you discussed around bus rapid transit, that is going to surprise and wow people around the country, around the world? Is it your train station? Is it congestion pricing? Is it transit expansion? I mean, what are you working on now that is going to be an innovation to watch?
Well, one piece, I'd like to broaden this conversation just a bit in the lens to say that infrastructure is most effective when it's that backbone for growth corridors. It's almost like it's the decoder ring for where growth makes most sense. And if you have a good game plan for investing in all forms of infrastructure, including broadband and everything we've talked about, then you're going to attract more investment. So I think having a roadmap like CMAP's plan, Go to 2040, and World Business Chicago's plan has helped us a great deal. But it's also about innovation, which is a theme I know you love, Bruce, of bringing innovation to how we pursue these opportunities. Congestion pricing is, again, a term that is not familiar to everyone, but the idea of using some of your road capacity and pricing it by time of day so that people can make a choice. You can go in the regular lane, or if you're late and you want that predictability of, oh, I can get from the start of my trip to the end of my trip because the sign promises me if I go into that lane, it's going to cost me a little bit more and I'll get there in 12 minutes. So people are willing to make those trade-offs. Data and technology is making a lot of this possible. A great example, one more, is Chicago's Union Station, which that train station carries actually more people every day than our second biggest airport, Midway Airport. Astounding. And yet we haven't invested in it per the theme today in way too long. Union Station has a master plan, which we're just starting to fund. It would help not only serve the commuters that use that station, serve the inner city Amtrak passengers, but it also is located in a part of Chicago that is our strongest commercial corridor. If we make Union Station a transportation center and a destination for retail and restaurants, it's going to anchor the next wave of growth for Chicago, and it becomes this virtuous cycle of infrastructure supporting economic development. That's the trend to watch.
So it sounds like infrastructure, broad and varied, not sexy, but essential. And, what I've always felt about Chicago is you're on task. I mean, there really is among the leadership network in the city and the metropolis a focus on what matters and literally just how do you get this done. So congratulations on the success to date.
Thanks. Lots of work ahead.
Mary Sue Barrett, thank you for being with us on POTUS today.
I appreciate it, Tim.
Thanks. Mary Sue Barrett, president of the Chicago Metropolitan Council, as we continue the Metropolitan Revolution. Bruce Katz is here. He's vice president, director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. I'm Tim Farley. And coming up, Angela Blanchard will join us, president, CEO of Neighborhood Centers, Inc. We'll talk about shifting demographics, immigration, that on the way as we continue here on POTUS.
You're listening to an exclusive POTUS event brought to you by the Brookings Institution. From the SiriusXM POTUS studios in Washington, D.C., here's Tim Farley with Bruce Katz of the Brookings Institution.
Bruce, by the way, Vice President, Director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program, and the co-author of The Metropolitan Revolution as It's Built, a distillation of the work on the emerging metropolitan-led next economy and its practitioners. Wow. Quite impressive. Sounds good. But we're getting the idea that, you know, some of the problems that are faced not just by large cities, but cities around the country, communities around the country. And that's part of what this program is about. And it's about solutions in many ways, too. We are now joined by Angela Blanchard, who's president, CEO of Neighborhood Centers, Inc., and joining us here on POTUS. Angela, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. It's good to be with you.
So, Angela, great to have you on the program as well. You know, when I think about some of the biggest challenges, frankly, opportunities facing cities and metropolitan areas in our country, it's demographic transformation. Not just the aging of our population, but the diversification of our population. And Houston is America on fast forward. I mean, more than 60% of your residents are people of color. Full 20% of residents are foreign-born. And how we integrate, particularly immigrants, into the mainstream of Americans' economy, how do we give them the skills they need to participate in the economy, is a critical challenge. You're probably doing a better job of this than just about any other organization I know of in the country. Could you describe Neighborhood Centers, Inc., and how you go about your business?
Well, I think, thank you. I think we are doing a good job of it, but I think the roots of our ability to respond to this opportunity lie in the Settlement House movement out of which we were born. So we remind everyone that in the late 1800s, early 1900s, we were welcoming people to this country, and their first stop was often a settlement house in which someone was saying, oh, welcome, and by the way, here's how democracy and capitalism work and your responsibilities and opportunities now that you're here. That formula then was about assimilation, meaning leave everything behind, become American. We have a really different formula going on now in the country, which is about an economic and political assimilation and a cultural independence and preservation. So in Houston, what I see happening is people coming here and bringing, self-selecting. The beauty of it is the folks that are coming here have already made a big declaration. They've rolled a large set of dice and saying, I think I have a better opportunity and I'm going for it. And they're coming and learning all they can as quickly as they can and going to work as fast as possible. I think that Houston has this landscape, first of all, a culture of being welcoming, but also a landscape that's wide and open, figuratively and literally. So we don't really share a past in Houston. Most of us came from somewhere else. We share a future. So it's a city that embraces the newcomer and says, what have you got to offer? And building on that through neighborhood centers and through a host of other very lively and engaged nonprofit efforts, we're pulling out the best out of people and putting them to work and integrating them into the fabric of what makes Houston a vibrant economy. It's a huge opportunity for us, and we have a lot of jobs. We're really glad that we have people showing up for them.
When I think about, and I've obviously visited neighborhood centers, when I think about the services you offer to residents of these communities, it's really quite remarkable. Access to low-cost banking, English as a second language, arts and culture, charter schools, access to health and skills. How did this come about? It's like a one-stop shop, you know, in areas that, you know, from the outside seem deprived, but actually the more time you spend there seem rich with opportunity.
Yeah. Well, I think it has a lot to do with the message that you've, so how it came about is a lot about your message in Metropolitan Revolution. It's a regional response. It's regions stepping up, taking stock of what's available, and then arranging it for some greater impact and success. So when we began looking at who was here, who was arriving, who was here, who was trying to move forward, what we did is really spend a great deal of time saying, what are you trying to achieve? What is your life goal? What is the most deeply held aspiration in your family? What are you working on? So we built on that
in these neighborhoods. We sought investment for neighborhoods and communities based upon what people had prioritized in their own lives and what they were working for. So everyone who arrives needs to understand our financial system, and it needs a point of entry that's not an intimidating downtown bank, but a point of entry where people can get educated and not be taken advantage of and have an opportunity to engage. Everyone wants to navigate, wants to learn a language. People want to understand the responsibilities of citizenship and civic participation. So we, through these centers, we put it all together in one place. Now, as you know, that's been a huge challenge because clearly nothing's funded in a non-siloed way. The world is a siloed world, organized efforts supported and funded through a very, through sometimes very deep and narrow silos. But through working in a very neighborhood-based fashion, we arrange those at a site in the neighborhood so from the standpoint of the people coming through there, it looks more seamless. I think there's one critical thing that we probably don't emphasize enough, and that's the value of community itself. The services are critically important, and we want in Houston to accelerate people's ability to move forward, to learn a language, to establish credit and financial relationships, to get their kids in great schools. We want to resource all the entrepreneurial activity, but we especially want people to feel connected to their neighbors and be close to one another and serve as a resource to one another. So we do a lot of fostering of community and connection neighborhood by neighborhood as well, and that proves to be very, very valuable in helping people move forward.
Angela Blanchard is with us, President and CEO of Neighborhood Centers, Inc., here on this special edition, The Metropolitan Revolution. Bruce Katz is here, Vice President of the Brookings Institution, Director of the Metropolitan Policy Program. I'm Tim Farley. And Angela, you said something interesting that it caught my attention. You said, we don't share a past, we share a future. When you say that, is there a shared vision of the future? I mean, we think of the old days. People said, yeah, I want the house with the white picket fence. What's the vision of the future that you share?
Yeah. So that really, what's very interesting to me is that there are three things that every community, every family, in some way will voice if you have a deep conversation. The aspiration for their children. I don't think anyone's ever held their child in their arms and not thought and dreamt of them having a life even richer and more fuller than the one we had as growing up. So we all long to provide opportunities for our children, to see our children go beyond us. The second thing I think that is really a driver for everyone is, if I work hard, is there a place for me in the world? And through my hard work, can I make that place and provide for my family? Use the things, the gifts, the talents, the skills I have, can I put those to work? That aspiration is huge. People come to Houston largely because they think this is the soil where if you plant that effort, it'll grow. And then the third thing is, will I belong? And this is so important because I've heard people say Houston has a flat social structure, it's a meritocracy, but I think it was described to me by, quite frankly, one of the world's wealthiest people said to me, I could live in any city in any country in the world, but I would never belong. In three months in Houston, I belonged. And I think that's true of the billionaire. It's also true of the relatively penniless newcomers. So I think this is a city that really largely looks forward together toward opportunity, belonging, and a better life for our children. So that's what we share. And everybody's approaching that in a different way. I mean, people are tackling those aspirations in their own way, in their own community, in their own neighborhood, but that is the shared aspiration.
You know, there are no barriers to entry in Houston. I really do regard it as a metropolis that is plug-in and play. And I think you're describing it very well. So let me just ask you this question. If you think about immigration reform at the national level, it's a partisan football. I mean, it's deeply divisive. When you go down to ground in Houston or Los Angeles or any of the cities and metro areas around the United States, it seems like there's a pragmatism of let's just, again, get about the business of getting stuff done. And so what's different between the local level and the national level in your perspective? Why are you able to make so much progress?
Well, I think of the national level is some kind of horribly dysfunctional extended family members that can't quite ever work anything out. At the local level, we do have a shared agenda and vision for this region that has to include everyone. It is not easy. I joke, we used to say when we wanted to talk about things being difficult, it's not like it would take an act of Congress. And I think, well, that's when Congress used to act. And it's very, very frustrating to see the suffering and the unnecessary pain that our failed immigration policies have caused. And we come face to face with it every day. But at the regional level, the practical matter is everyone here understands we need everyone. And particularly right now in the Houston region, we need everyone. Unemployment is very low here. We face a prospect next year of anywhere between 100,000 or more unfilled jobs. We need everyone. And we are the people who support our programs believe that we need the people that are arriving here, and we wish the laws would reflect that. And that's people on both sides of the political fence. When we look at the people standing before us, we're saying, yes, these are the very people we need to do what we're about to do in this economy, and we want an immigration reform that reflects that. In the meantime, people are supporting our efforts for people to learn English. They're funding our efforts to help people navigate what is a very broken immigration system. They are funding our efforts to help Dreamers, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that program to help them with their applications, because Houston practically understands these are people that once you know them, once you're face to face with them, we need them and we want them. So we're doing it all that we can with what we have where we are right now. So
I think that's very helpful. And also just thanks for confirming in a very concrete and tangible way why I think we're demographically blessed as a country. Tim, if you ever want to feel good about America, go visit what is a 21st century network of settlement houses in Houston. Angela, thanks for being on.
Oh, thank you. This has been a real pleasure to visit with you guys.
Thank you, Angela. Angela Blanchard, President, CEO of Neighborhood Centers Incorporated, as we are wrapping up this edition of the Metropolitan Revolution. And Bruce, as I said in the beginning, I heard a lot of wheez, and I still am hearing a lot of wheez because there seems to be a sense of team in taking this on. Obviously, we didn't get into as many areas as we could have because in the book you talk about New York City, you've got Portland, Oregon, sustainability. There's other cities that you look at. So we will link the book to our Facebook page, facebook.com/POTUSpolitics. Just in general, though, I do feel a little bit better because there are obviously a lot of problems, but it seems that there are some people out there who have the wherewithal to take them on and are trying to, in as you use the expression, concrete ways, try to make things a little bit better.
Yeah, what I always say when I go around the United States is the health and vibrancy of our country is not dependent on 537 elected officials in Washington, D.C.
Thank goodness.
There's really tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of leaders out there and mm-hmm. citizens in our cities and metropolitan areas that are rolling up their sleeves every day mm-hmm. and putting their shoulder to the wheel. And so I think I need to write another book. There are a lot of examples out there.
More travel, more valued miles. So, Bruce, I appreciate you spending time with us on POTUS today. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Bruce Katz, Vice President, Director, Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. I'm Tim Farley. I want to thank Catherine Caperton for producing this program. Once again, The Metropolitan Revolution, a special production here on POTUS Sirius XM 124.